Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a moment, half a century of ecumenical efforts. The Pontifical Council for Christian Unity marks its 50th birthday. And how the other half live, why it's vital to make the voice of the poor heard by those seeking solutions to the global economic crisis. June the 5th marks the official birthday of the Vatican's Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity, set up half a century ago by Pope John the 23rd in the lead-up to the Second Vatican Council. That great meeting of the worldwide church would literally revolutionise the way Catholics related to Christians from other churches and communities. No longer would Catholics be warned to stay away from people of other denominations, but rather they'd be encouraged to pray with them, to discern the Spirit at work, and to find ways of working together on all kinds of common concerns. But just how did that extraordinary change of attitude come about? Why did church leaders suddenly see it was time to put aside centuries of division and bitter conflict and to try and answer Christ's own prayer on the eve of the crucifixion, that they may be one?
The world today needs the common witness of Christians. The fact that they are divided hinders the work of the church, and I do hope that we could all be trustful that the Holy Spirit, which has given us so much grace to walk the path of ecumenical closeness, in the last 50 years, we'll continue to do this.
Bishop Brian Farrell is Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. During the recent Edinburgh Conference on Unity and Mission, I sat down with him to find out more about the founding of his council and his hopes for the ecumenical movement today.
It's interesting, we just celebrated the 100th anniversary of Edinburgh 1910, which symbolically is taken as the beginning of the modern ecumenical movement. And during the conference itself, we remembered the foundation of the Secretariat for Promoting Christian Unity, which was set up in 1960 by Pope John the 23rd in order to bring into the discussions of the Council his concern for the unity of Christians. How it happened, it's a beautiful story of the Pope wanting to bring observers from the other Christian churches, the Orthodox and the Protestant churches, to the Council, and having a need for a group of people that would commit themselves to visiting these churches and inviting them to send observers. This was the beginning of the Secretariat. Later, the Secretariat, the beginning of the Council, took on a more formal structure and became instrumental in promoting the various questions that were particularly important to Pope John the 23rd and to Cardinal Bea, the first president of the Secretariat, such as Christian unity, freedom of conscience, the question of the relations of the Catholic Church to the world Jewish community. These themes were deeply and at length debated during the Council, and as I have often said, one of the great untold stories is how the Secretariat, during the 4 years of the Council, educated the bishops in the particular issues and questions that were being debated.
It is an extraordinary achievement, isn't it? Because, as you said, most of these bishops had been educated in an exclusivist Catholic theology. How do you think this great turnaround was made possible? Was it the Pope himself?
Well, of course, the ferment was already in the liturgical, biblical, theological renewal of the first part of the 20th century. But it all came together, if you wish, in the discussions of the council, the spark being for this new enkindling of Catholic theology, the spark being the particular emphasis given by Pope John the 23rd to the question of a renewal of the Church, bringing it into dialogue with the questions of the day, and his insistence on the question of Christian unity, which his experience of living in Eastern Europe had undoubtedly stamped on his soul.
And so he was able in this way to bring so many other bishops on board that it really pushed the work of the council forward, didn't it?
Well, the secretariat at that time, as it was called then, worked very hard during the period of the council and even in the months between the various sessions, organizing study groups, organizing symposia, preparing documents to send to the council for discussion. During the sessions of the council, not only were they in constant contact with the observers from all the other churches, meeting with them at least once a week to discuss how the council was going forward, to bring up the questions that were of interest to the other churches, but also doing a kind of educational effort with the rest of the Catholic bishops so that they would understand the deeper theological questions behind the documents being discussed.
There were those at that time who were very opposed, though, weren't they, to this kind of change?
Well, to move a whole world episcopate from the kind of ecclesiology by which Christians were not visibly members of the Catholic Church, were simply considered to be outside the Church, to the point where we have a marvelous document which deserves to be read again and again, Unitatis Redintegratio, a document which recognizes that in all of these communities, and not just in the individuals who are baptized, but in all of these communities, the Holy Spirit works to build up the Church of Christ, and that the work of sanctification and mission is carried out through them.
The ecumenical movement, of course, has been going on for the past five decades, huge changes, and yet it's worked in some places much better than others. What do you think has been the determining factor in really pushing this movement ahead over the past half century?
Well, of course, each part of the world is different. Each country is different from the context. If there are no members or very few members of other churches, and we have a huge majority of Catholics, the sense of need and urgency is perhaps less evident. If, on the other hand, Catholics are a minority, of course they're used to living in that situation, and ecumenism, in other words, relations between churches, are on the menu every day. Other factors, of course, are very important, such as the level of personal commitment on the part of the bishops. This is very important, that they understand that the ecumenical commitment, as all of the popes since John the 23rd have constantly repeated and shown in their teaching and in their pastoral activity, is a priority for the Church. The Council showed us that the division among Christians is not just a scandal, we shouldn't be divided according to the will of Christ, but that it harms the great task of preaching the gospel to the world. The Lord prayed for the unity of his disciples so that the world might believe. And it is clear that the ecumenical movement was founded on this principle, that as long as we are divided, we will not be able to carry out this command that the Lord gave us, to preach the gospel.
The ecumenical work began with the post-Reformation churches, the Anglican, the Lutheran, the Reformed churches. It's now broadened out to include the much newer Pentecostal, evangelical churches mm-hmm. and movements. How has this changed the work that started 50 years ago?
Yeah, I would just like to say that there has never been a time when the question of unity was not important to the church. And if you go back, we have the councils that tried to restore unity between East and West and so forth. But certainly after the Reformation, the question became much more present and pressing. With the churches of the Reformation period, there has been a substantial dialogue that has been going on now for 40 years. And the results are significant. We have not been able to solve all the questions, all the controversies of the 16th century, but great headway has been made. Now we are also in dialogue with these churches which have grown up during the 20th century under the influence of this new wave of what we might call Protestant communities, which are substantially connected with the experience of the Holy Spirit and a kind of return to the charisms and signs of the presence of the Holy Spirit that we read about, for example, in the Acts of the Apostles. These today are expanding communities. They constitute a large part of the Christian world. We have been in dialogue with some of these groups for decades, more recently with others. But because of a lack of ecclesial structures and an ecclesiology that would give them more structure, it is very difficult to find the people who would actually represent this type of Christianity.
Most of these, or many of these groups, were represented at the Edinburgh Conference at the beginning of June. What do you think, if you had to summarise the real fruits, the results of that conference? Yes.
Well, for the last 15 years, there has been a great interest in the ecumenical world to try to bring the Pentecostal charismatic churches into the ecumenical dialogue. In general, they have been reluctant to do that because of their theological outlook on other Christians. But there is a process called the Global Christian Forum, which has offered them the opportunity to take part in meetings with others, with the Protestant churches of the World Council of Churches and with the Catholic Church, which has been present and works closely with the World Council of Churches, although we are not members. But this recent event in Edinburgh was certainly a step forward insofar as the Pentecostal and charismatic churches felt not just invited, but felt that they had a right to be there, and they took part in a full sense in the activities of this great conference.
So we hope that this will lead on to other significant developments, perhaps.
Well, of course, we're looking at a long journey into the future because the differences in ecclesiology especially, although on fundamental issues we may have greater similarity in questions of Trinitarian doctrine or questions of Christology and the theology of the Holy Spirit, we may agree on many things, we still have to learn from each other who we are, what we stand for, what are the issues that need to be discussed so that we can know each other better and maybe journey together towards greater collaboration and closeness. It's not possible to think that in any short term we will reach any kind of unity. That's not the immediate goal of our conversations with these communities.
But you're hopeful as you look forward to the next half century?
Of course, yes. If you look back 50 years, this council has seen extraordinary changes, progress in our relations with the other churches. I make a point of returning to the great encyclical letter of Pope John Paul II on ecumenism, Ut Unum Sint, in which he says that perhaps the most significant result of this new relationship is what he calls brotherhood rediscovered. In other words, we are no longer fighting each other, we are no longer in rivalry, we are trying to respond to the will of Christ that we should be one.
Thanks there to Bishop Brian Farrell, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. Across the Western world, governments continue to search for far-reaching solutions to the global economic crisis, trying to hammer out some form of regulation for the banks and financial institutions at the heart of the crisis. But while there's plenty of media coverage about the way the recession has hit consumers, companies, and national budgets in our developed countries, there's much less news coverage about the impact the crisis has had on the developing world, on the people living on less than a dollar or two a day.
The ones who pay the biggest price when we have a financial crisis are the poor.
Father Seamus Finn heads the Justice, Peace and Integrity of Creation Office for the Oblates of Mary Immaculate in Washington, D.C. He has a keen interest in ethical investment and corporate responsibility, working with other faith-based organisations to keep such ethical and moral issues on the agenda of governments, corporations and financial institutions. He believes it's vital to continue making the voice of the poor heard in the corridors of economic and political power.
This is an area that we have spent, and by we I'm talking about the Oblates and other religious orders in the States. We've spent a lot of time focusing on the global financial system in a variety of different sectors over the years, starting all the way back from apartheid issues to the Latin American debt issues. Founded, I think, on our belief that, you know, the global financial system is kind of, it's the vascular system of operations of commerce in the world. This is how people have access to loans. This is how they get credit if they want to open a small business. Even if you want to talk about microfinance or microcredit or small, medium type enterprises. And so we have been keenly interested about two things, about the fact that the system has to be reliable, and that it has to benefit, that the social purpose of the financial system is to help people to sustain their lives and the livelihoods of those who are dependent on them, and not to harm the earth in the process. And so the social purpose of the financial system is something that we're keenly concerned about. And then access to actual financial resources, whether it's a loan or credit, is the second piece. And I think we've been extremely concerned about the amount of speculation that's been introduced into the financial system and the excess profits that have been taken by some in the financial system and what I would call the financialization of life and commodities in themselves. It's the financial sector continues to grow exponentially in most economies. And I think the issue, you put it alongside, it was easy maybe in some ways to look at apartheid or to look at Latin American debt and deal with Bank X or Bank Y or one government or another. When you put an overlay of that of globalization on top of that, and you put the global financial integration that's gone on in the last 25 years, then you really now do have a global financial system. It's got some basic, very important centers that differentiate it from the Eurozone to the U.S. or to Asia. But then if it's all integrated, I think it's important to say, well, who is actually in charge and who's actually setting the rules and who's actually monitoring to see if the rules are obeyed. And I think one of my biggest concerns has been with the global financial system, you've got every country and every region wanting to do its own regulating and its own monitoring. And to a point that works, but we're now in a position in the present financial crisis that we're trying to pass some significant legislation in the U.S., and the banks are saying to us, well, if you pass the legislation, we're moving to the U.K. Then if the U.K. suggests we're going to pass some legislation, they're saying, well, we might be moved to Frankfurt. And I was extremely disappointed the other day. The financial ministers of the G20 met, I believe, in Toronto, getting ready for the G20 meeting coming up, and they really could not agree on some kind of global financial authority, which I think the Holy Father calls for in the last encyclical, and some people equated it with a global government, which I don't think is not at all the case. But they were not able to agree that this needs to happen, so we continue to have what in the lingo is called regulatory arbitrage. You're going to go where you have the least regulation. And my biggest concern in this area is that this is what got us into trouble to begin with, is that if you don't have somebody verifying, you know, the facts and verifying the monitoring the behaviors, whether it's in the Eurozone or the U.S. or the global financial system, then it's ripe for exploitation, whether it's by motivation of greed or crime or whatever. And most particularly, the ones who pay the biggest price when we have a financial crisis are the poor. Particularly the poor who may only be accessing $2 of credit a month. Most people on Wall Street that I know, they're not going without food and they're not going without the regular things that they have available. Their bonuses are going to sustain them quite well, and some of them are wealthy for many years into the future. So the issue becomes, how do you emphasize with them or bring their attention to the fact that the impact of what they're doing in capital markets, in trading, in their activities, are having huge impacts across the world. One of the obvious ones most recently was the amount of speculation in the derivatives market on, for instance, the price of food. I mean, we had food riots all over the world last year in terms of speculating on what rice is going to cost in a few months and driving up the price. Then, yeah, that might be fine for your investment and for the return on your investment, but in the person going to the market in Malawi or Zambia or in Asia to buy rice, they're going to have to say, well, where am I going to come up with the extra money to buy rice for today's food or for today's meals?
And yet you're saying that the lessons don't seem to have been learned from this past crisis, that people are not willing to make the necessary changes to stop this happening again.
I think individual countries have done a good job in certain sectors, but they're still looking out for their own interest, whether it's their own banks or their own service sectors and their own financial areas. What the absolute kind of level of collaboration and coordination at a regional and a global level is just not there. And in some ways, I think political leaders are maybe held captive on this. This has been an extremely difficult 2 years now. The crisis was in full bloom in September of 2008, so we're coming up on the second anniversary. There have been, you know, millions of people have lost their jobs and their livelihoods. Millions of people have lost their homes in the United States. The impact in terms of developing countries is immeasurable. So if I'm an elected leader and I'm looking to go to the next election, in some ways, yeah, I want to be reelected, and so I'm somehow held captive to these financiers and to the folks who run the financial system to say, well, need to spend more and to put more government money into the economy, so you'll create more jobs, but you'll create more debt. I don't find either the industry coming forward, and by that I mean the major world banks and banking centers, coming forward with a reliable proposal in terms of structure and regulation that would make the system more stable, more safe, and actually offer access to loans and to credit that people need. And on the political side, I'm not sure that the regulators, who the politicians are ultimately responsible for passing the laws and putting in place the regulations, I am not sure that they're convinced exactly what's the best thing. I mean, this is a financial system that grows very quickly, moves very rapidly, and they're not by training economists, so they're trying to come up with some solutions. And at the moment, based on recent events, I'm not terribly hopeful.
The Church has been pressing for many years, though, for a closer look at these moral and ethical issues, which will ultimately also provide a safer future along these lines that you're talking about. What else can you do? I mean, it's quite a depressing picture, as you say, with little hope of reform.
I think from a church point of view, I think we've been pretty clear that we believe such things as greater transparency, accountability, and actual monitoring and disclosure are at least a good first step in terms of a financial system. So that, for instance, in the recent crisis, much of the problem was related to off the balance sheet liabilities. So we want the banks, the institutions, we want to bring all of their liabilities and their assets onto the balance sheet so you can actually see how much do they owe, how much do they have, and one gets a clear picture, and I think that's a basic principle that needs to be applied. I think the church has been clear, and I think maybe this is a new opportunity to try and explore this question of the virtue of solidarity. By asking, perhaps in previous times we talked more about distributive justice and social justice. I think we need to kind of contemporaneize those principles and kind of say, you know, if we're going to have a global financial system, if we're going to have a global economy, what needs to be put in place so that most people have access to the kinds of credit that they need? And what does that mean in terms of the kind of regulation of markets? What does that mean in terms of the kinds of responsibilities? A corporation may have a license to operate. Does it have a social license to operate? How are they treating their clients? How are they treating their investors? How are they treating the local communities? And I think the church has continued to push that the investor, most of the investors tend to be in the North, are whether it's an individual investor or somebody in a pension fund scheme, they need to be more vigilant. That is not a question of just simply taking your investment and buying shares in a bank or putting it in there. You may also need to say, well, what's the bank doing with my money while it's there? And does the bank have a code of ethics? And if they do have a code of ethics or a human rights policy or a community relations policy, are they actually implementing it? And can I actually look and see, oh yeah, there's an example of when it was implemented. So I think the church's contribution on this can be, I think, to provide guidance on the principled level in terms of ethics and morality, but also I think to help people to become more active themselves as shareholders and as investors, and whether it's the local credit union or the bank or the multinational corporation, take the time to try and find out, you know, is this corporation actually contributing positively to humankind and producing a sustainable development kind of option for local communities and for regions.
Thanks there to Father Seamus Finn, who heads the Justice, Peace and Integrity of Creation Office for the Oblates of Mary Immaculate in Washington, D.C. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at the same time tomorrow, if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You'll find all our news and feature programmes there, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.